Speaking of reliability, friends talking about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Hi, my name's Chris Jackson.
And this is Adam Barrett.
And we're talking about some of the things that have happened in the history of reliability. And Adam, you were talking about, I think you're talking about the Iron Age.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. It was an assignment somebody kind of gave me in a conversation I had, and we were talking about metals. And they said, well, what's your favorite metal? And I was like, well, it's definitely iron. I mean, and they said, why? And I'm like, it's the one that's changed technology in one of the most fundamental ways. I mean, to such an extent that there's the Iron Age. It, you know, defined an entire period of time. And it's always interesting to think about that. You know, what causes big jumps like that in technology and what people use.
And so, and does that have relevance for the things you're talking about in terms of a reliability conversation, or is this just a, let's call it, engineering epoch?
No, it definitely turns to reliability very quickly, because here's the thing with technology jumps. When a new technology is created, it doesn't have a lot of value. It's always impressive and amazing, but the value is not there until it becomes something that's robust and can be depended on and is effectively matured, right? I mean, even look today with, you know, things, the things that they keep, you know, happening with carbon, or we're going to have, you know, microcell carbon, super strength, this and that, and you keep hearing about it year after year, and they still haven't gotten it to where they can make it consistently reliable, so it's had no impact yet. And I think that with metallurgy, you know, we discovered gold early on, and then, you know, copper, and we made brass, but all of these are not very good structural metals. And then when iron was discovered, whoever had got control of it, they changed the planet, right? It was, those were the cultures that then were able to go forward and dominate, right? So once they figured out, because when you find iron on its own is an amazing discovery, it's not very useful, raw iron.
So when's the reliability age starting?
Right. So as soon as they figured out how to make steel, now they can make it as a reliable, consistent, and they figured out how to make it steel and to make and understand hardness, you know, and make it consistent and the methods to create it. All of a sudden, then you can make swords that didn't crack. Right. And, yeah. And, you know, make axes that could cut wood faster than any stone on the end of a stick, you know, and raw iron will not do that. It'll just crack and break. You know, it depends on how much carbon you put when you make it. So it wasn't until they really matured it that it became powerful. Otherwise, it was just this alloy that rusts. And like I said, you know, we see that today with carbon nanotubes. Right. It's going to be the most amazing thing ever. But we haven't figured out how to, you know, making anything consistent. And you can, I think you can mark a lot of periods in time with technology where there's big technology discoveries and then that delay until it became mature. Really, the maturity process is through reliability.
And I suppose if you're looking at how things change over time and things, new technologies that have changed the world, many surveys have said the printing press is the most, let's just say, important invention of all time, and there's a case to be made for that. And if you look at what Joseph Gutenberg did with the printing press, and there are several replicas that exist to this day, you look at a very, very robust device that conceivably, if it had been maintained properly for 500 years, should still be working perfectly well. Compare that to today, where we where the term over-engineering is actually a term. It certainly wasn't a term back in Gutenberg's day when he was designing this printing press, because that thing was a monstrous beast that was never going to fail. So has anything changed between then and now? Or is there an epoch or some sort of time change or era change?
Well, I think the fact that we allow products to wear out is showing that we do understand how to mature them with even more refinement. Because if you think about it, when you make something overly robust, it's because you don't have really good understanding or control of all the variabilities, right? You go overkill. And that's why that's why I have my grandfather's tools that he bought, right? Like at this point, probably like 70 years ago. They all work amazing. But they're all like three times the weight of a regular tool and, you know, overkill. And it's because they, one, maybe didn't have the motivation to try to make it exactly the right, you know, reliability. And today, you hit a better cost point and have a product people will buy if you technology moves so fast that you don't want the same product probably 5 years later, not because it wore out, but because you know there's something that is of new features that you want. So by doing the right reliability work, you can hit the exact right cost point and make something that wears out in 5 years but costs less, which the consumer is going to choose. So I think actually the fact that things don't last as long shows that we understand reliability better.
I think what you're talking about, and I think I agree with you if this is where you're heading, is you're talking about a useful life or an operational life of something where back hundreds of years ago, that wasn't a thing because you would reasonably expect the tools a father used to be used by the son and his son and so on and so forth because, again, technology wasn't changing that fast.
Right, exactly. And there was no, you know, need for that. Yeah, having a tools you could hand down generation after generation that cost 20% more was well worth it, right? Because hammers didn't change, wrenches didn't change. But now it's my TV, I switch out not because it breaks, but because I want the latest technology. So cost points, you know, a big deal. And I mean, Ferdinand Porsche is quoted as saying, the perfect race car falls apart right after the finish line. That's if you design it correctly, right? If you design it correctly, you didn't carry around an ounce of weight. You didn't have to around the racetrack. You know, you didn't, you know. And there's a lot to be said for that. That's real amazing engineering if you can do that. And that's what reliability aims to do. And just this past week, since I was speaking in Stuttgart, I actually got to go to the Porsche Museum and the Mercedes Museum. I actually wrote it in my contract that they had to take me the day after it. And then they agreed. Yeah, I did. I was like, I want the full Ferris Bueller day where you take me to the city and have a blast. And of course, you know, it gave them an excuse to go. And you know, you talk about the first things there. I saw the first car ever in the Mercedes Museum. It's there and it still works, you know. And some of it is because it's so simple. And another is because it's a motor that has the weight and size of what we could get out of a 20 horsepower motor now, but it has like 4 horsepower, you know, right? So the stress levels are so low, it's amazing.
And then that's the whole racing car concept is born out of the Industrial Revolution, where all of a sudden you could produce these parts where people could use these things. And I suppose the Industrial Revolution was the first time where there is an organized effort to actually start measuring productivity and say, we can do things better. When we talk about measuring productivity, essentially you're trying to calculate and reduce waste. So I suppose what Ferdinand Porsche was saying is essentially the same thing that those industrial engineers were saying back in the 1800s or talking about, to try and not invest too much money into getting our useful life out of product X.
Right. A lot of people don't understand that with a good reliability program is that it actually can support cost reduction dramatically, right? Because, if you go way back, the cost reduction effort would happen after the design effort. And, you know, they end up undoing what some of the designers wanted to accomplish or had demonstrated was necessary. But if you've done the right reliability work, you've developed the tests and understanding of stress to failure mode relationships and the tests that measure it, to where you could do cost reduction and say, hey, this area has way more margin than we need. Why don't we back this down? Or this other area where they try to pull out costs and you say, you know, whoa, hold on a second. This has pretty small margin already. Exactly. And you can optimize for cost. You can optimize for weight. You can optimize for anything because you understand the product better.
So I got the Iron Age where we talked about, where you say, finally we had metals that could last and potentially last generations. Mm. And mate, we also talked about the concept of over-engineering, which was a term which only came into fruition in the 20th century. It never used to be a thing. The Industrial Revolution, where we talked about people started focusing on waste and productivity. So what else happened? Are we missing anything?
Of others. There's the, 185 years ago, I don't know, whatever, it was the first time they figured out how to take electromagnetism and turn it into mechanical motion, right? DC and AC motors. Is it right? Was it that long ago? I think it was. I think it was really that long ago, actually. Being able to take electricity and turn it into mechanical motion, or mechanical motion turn to electricity, is tremendous. Actually, that was something that was at the Porsche Museum was... And the Ferdinand Porsche in 1903 designed a diesel electric hybrid car that he raced and beat everybody. It had an electric motor in each hub. Like, it was unbelievable. It was something totally like modern day. And this is over 100 years ago. It's like 115 years ago. And, So, but again, it wasn't until the limiting factor was the maturity of certain technologies to where it could compete with the advancement of pure gasoline and what was needed to optimize. But that thing was sitting right there. It was unbelievable. And so I think the electric connecting electromagnetism to mechanical rotary motion changed everything. I mean, try and think of any, you know, the amount of products today we have that use electric motors. It's unreal. And then, of course, chemical combustion, right? Chemical to mechanical motion, you know, burning fuels was another tremendous one that changed, you know, a lot. And then, you know, that then, you know, I guess you could fast forward about 60 years to the invention of the, you know, of semiconductors, right?
And then it's funny. Sorry, yeah?
No, sorry, go ahead.
The saying is that I've noticed a common thread of a couple of things. Ferdinand Porsche was German, and so was, I think, Robert Lusselaar, who worked on the V1 rocket for the then Nazi German regime. But he was the first guy, another German, who said, look, this reliability engineering thing, our products are getting so complicated now that all our design effort, all the human being design effort, what's inside our heads, needs to be focused on designing something that can work, and we need to have specialists who are able to look at what these other designers do and say, let's make something that will work. So it's just funny how, funny is the right word, but I suppose coincidental that you have Ferdinand Porsche, who's clearly ahead of his time in terms of an approach to useful life, and again, out of what was a horrific time in modern history, also coincided with the realization that reliability engineering needs to be its own thing. You just can't, it can't be a hobby, or it can't be just an additional string to a bow.
Exactly, yeah. We just leave it to the designer at his desk. And it's funny, we talk about reliability culture and how businesses do product development culture, but it also is the actual literal culture, nationality culture, that certain cultures lend themselves to certain skill sets, just for whatever reason. I have my mm-hmm. theories about different ones, but obviously the German one is, you know, the cliche is how meticulous they are, right? And they're always on time, yep. And they're always, you know, they have that precision. And of course, that interest in precision, and if that's your goal and that's what you're trying to accomplish, that obviously would take you towards a lot of the reliability tool set. You know, which is interesting because I always have that thing I talk about when people let me. The reason why Asian culture is always been associated with high reliability and Western's been associated with high creativity. I believe the origins are the difference between a rice-based agriculture and a wheat-based agriculture.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The rice, if you look at what it takes to grow rice, it requires intense monitoring and constant adjustment every day. You have to adjust the water levels, the angle, the composites underneath it. If you neglect a rice paddy for a few days, it easily can all, you know, become undone and your family starves. So, if you look at agriculture as the origins of where technology kind of was applied, I mean, the very first invention really was like plaster, and was for storing food, and then tools for food. And as we did less of hunting and foraging and more settling, technology really, you know, the birth of it was based around food. And So you can see how that would kind of cultivate in the Asian cultures that had rice-based, you know, food staples would be to do this kind of like quality inspection and maintenance, you know, this very kind of, as we know them, to be high reliability, high quality. And then on the other side with Western, with wheat, it's two huge surges of activity followed by periods of just waiting to see what happens. You have to plant, which, you know, the more you can plant, the farther you can go, the more land you can do it. In that short time period, the more wheat you'll generate. So obviously that's innovation and technology and tool, you know, coming up with creative ways to do it better. Same thing with harvesting. The more you can harvest, again, the same thing, invention. And you have periods to experiment in between. So you can do a better job feeding your family if you're good at being creative. And so, you know, I guess that kind of sets up a little bit as to why Western culture does so good in inventing and Eastern does so good with quality, and why now we're trying to both share, why we're all reading the Toyota way, because we want to understand how they do it better. And they are now in academic courses making it a requirement to take invention courses, because a lot of Asian engineers are hesitant to invent, or, you know, it has historically not been as encouraged.
Okay. Well, I suppose, I mean, we talk about the Japanese culture when it comes to manufacturing a lot. And depending on who you speak to, many suggest that the Japanese manufacturing industry before World War II wasn't renowned for quality. It was certainly after the after World War II, when essentially the entire country was run in a very technocratic way. They really did do wonderful things with how they produced and manufactured their products. So, we should note that they actually got Western quality practitioners, W. Edward Deming and Joseph Durand, to come across and help them on their journey. So, does that align with your rice and wheat analogy?
No, it doesn't. Those are, you know, other factors. And what you're saying is true. Exactly. Some of it did come from the West. But, I mean, I think there's lots of factors that can affect different time periods. And I think in those earlier time periods for Japan, I think you can look at, as far as the way technology was being incorporated and the objective may have not been as much high quality and high reliability. It wasn't as critical. Material sourcing was a big one that had an effect on kind of and lower levels of innovation. So yeah, without a doubt, it has not been consistent through their whole history. But the fact that it was adapted so well, and when they did become to embrace it, it was such an easy thing for them to be so effective, the way we're describing with the Germans, that when there is opportunities for that lend themselves to a meticulous behavior being advantageous, they shine.
It might be something. And again, let's not forget that Durand and Demings were essentially ignored by the Western cultures from which they came until the Japanese.
Right. So there you go. We didn't value it. So, you know, where people, individuals, of course, are very diverse. But I think maybe that's the proof, right? That it even proves it further, that they were part of Western culture, and Western culture was like, who cares? It doesn't matter. Whoever makes the next new coolest thing matters, who has bigger fins on the back of their car and who, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then when he went over to the Eastern culture, they were like, okay, this is good. Maybe the fact of how the two embraced it is an indicative of their culture.
Absolutely. And I'm always talking about this cultural thing as well. I always ask people to look at YouTube when they're trying to talk about, they're trying to learn more about how culture affects quality and reliability and things like that. There's a video on YouTube called "If the Japanese Can Do It, Why Can't We?" And I think it's a CNN or CBS documentary, but it was done in 1980 or 1981, I believe. And it's essentially a US-based perspective across the Pacific Ocean, looking at Japanese manufacturing processes and why they're so much better than Western processes in terms of their efficiency and quality and reliability and costs.
Yeah.
And the reason I ask people to look at that particular video is because many of the issues that the documentary highlights in terms of Western manufacturing are so eerily similar to what we experience today. So that it's like the more things change, the more some things at least stay the same. And it's always the same few idioms of reliability wisdom that tend to persevere over time.
Yeah, it is interesting. I mean, when you look at it, what was the price really paid? When was the price paid? And it really wasn't until 2008, right? I mean, it was like early 2000s when GM was surpassed by Toyota as the biggest automotive manufacturer in the world. So for all that talk of how, you know, American car companies are failing and not doing well through the 70s, 80s, 90s, I mean, it really wasn't until just a few years ago that really manifested into something. So it's, you know, it really is that recent, you know, that manifested into kind of truly to where we really do have to be motivated to do it. You say things, things changing but staying the same. We're still actually, I think some of the effects of the end of World War II are still in play, where if you think about the industrial state of these different countries, at the end of World War II, America had not had any bombings on our homeland, you know, aiming at, you know, targeting our industry, whereas Japan and Germany, I mean, those were the literal targets, was to get rid of the manufacturing processes. And ours had the opposite. Ours were built up because the government invested in them heavily. So these automotive manufacturers that were size X before the war were size 3X after. So, I mean, from a competitive nature, where was the competition? We could sell cars and things that had crappy reliability, and where else were you going to go, you know, to get something better?
It's interesting, and I think a conversation about Toyota overtaking GM as the world's biggest automobile manufacturer isn't complete with some of the issues Toyota faced in the sudden unintended acceleration of its vehicles and Lexus cars was a big issue. And in fact, I think they still remain as the most heavily fined organization of all time, at least from the US federal government's perspective, because they didn't take the quality of their electronic throttle control system seriously. And for those who are unaware of what I'm talking about, there are a number of Toyota manufactured vehicles which just randomly accelerated out of control and killed, I think, almost 100 people when it all was said and done. And after they were forced to acknowledge that this was a quality or reliability issue, the company said, look, in the 1990s, we sat down and said, we want to be the world's biggest automobile manufacturer. And to do that, they actually had to sort of move away from the Toyota way, which was to have very strong relationships with his suppliers, and anyone on the production line could halt production if they saw an issue. So they had to quickly expand and quickly forge relationships with new suppliers and so on and so forth. So to get to where you're talking about, Adam, some may argue they had to move away from their own Toyota way. So it's always the yin and the yang, which is perhaps a good analogy.
You're spot on. And the thing is that you're always to be, you know, fill a market. It doesn't mean you make the most reliable product. It means you satisfy the customers. And so what they were effectively acknowledging was customers care about cost point more than these factors, and they were letting that pressure affect them. And it's kind of funny. I ended up having to give a big apology at the beginning of my talk in Stuttgart because there were a lot of Mercedes people in the audience, and I've written a couple articles about Mercedes recently. Yep. And you know, one of them is that, you know, they, and especially going through their museum, right, and talking with people, and I had a great tour guide, you know, it was the 80s or 90s where they began to deviate from their practices of the best or nothing, right, was their motto.
Yep.
And now to where the new C-Class in America was ranked, they had to give it a negative reliability ranking because it was so low. I don't know how you get negative, but they did. But it's one of the best-selling cars. And so they've nailed it. Mercedes has nailed it, that the customers don't care about reliability. The customers they're going after, they want new technology, style, status. And the lower you can get the cost point for those things, the more their sales go up. So if you want to, you know, criticize Mercedes for reliability and abandoning their known as being bulletproof, you can. You cannot criticize their business success based on their new set of priorities. So it's interesting. So are they running a business, or are they trying to make the best car in the world? And they're running a business. And like Rolls-Royce, really, they went out of business effectively at a point where their name was sold, and now you can buy Rolls-Royces, but the Rolls-Royce company, automotive company's gone. Mm-hmm. And the reason why is they were overly reliable. They had a specification for optically clear windshields, basically like eyeglasses. So they would like have to make 13 windshields, I think, for every one that made it past quality control into a car. So
amazing.
Right. So everybody who buys a car is buying 14 windshields, basically, from a cost standpoint, right? So at some point, people are like, wait, I don't care. It's going to have stone chips anyway in 6 months. You know, what does it matter if it's optically perfect? So you can, from a business standpoint, make a mistake on the other end.
So perhaps the next time we talk about this, maybe we could stop focusing on, well, not focus on the past as much, and maybe speculate on the reliability ages of the future.
Yes. Yeah, it is interesting. It is interesting to see how, I mean, it's only a factor in a product, right? There's lots of factors.
And the good thing about talking about the future is you're never wrong, at least in that point in time.
No, you're not. Just don't record it. Oh, wait a minute.
That's right. Well, perhaps on that note, we might leave it there. And we'd invite anyone of our listeners to look at Ascendo Reliability. You can certainly subscribe to this podcast and others. But if there's any comments, please feel free to get back to us. And if there's anything else you'd like us to talk about more specifically, please send your suggestions our way. But Adam, thanks for your time today.
Yeah, it's great. And thank you, everybody, for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We love doing the podcast, and I absolutely love when people come up and talk about it and, you know, get to hear what they think as a listener. So thank you, everybody.
No worries. Well, until then, enjoy reliability.
All right. Take care. Bye.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.